Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on your YouTube channel. I'm Deborah J. Saunders, columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, and a token conservative blogger for SFGate, your moderator for the program. And now I'm pleased to introduce our distinguished speaker, Ralph Nader. Political activist, former presidential candidate, and author of the new book, Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. Please welcome Ralph Nader.
Thank you very much, Deborah. Thank the Commonwealth Club. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being here. I think we share a lot in common in our country, and that is we want to get things done. We're rather upset by inability of decision makers for purposes of their own careers or their own avarice or their own myopia, simply not leading, not reflecting what Abraham Lincoln called the public sentiment. He once said, with the public sentiment, you can do anything. Without the public sentiment, you can't do very much at all. We also, whether we call ourselves conservatives, liberals, libertarians, or progressives, we also have not been individually winning much these days. One of the reasons is because in the time-honored strategy of divide and rule, the people who have extraordinary power in this country, whether they're in Washington or whether they're in Wall Street, relish focusing on the areas of disagreement between, just to shortcut the categories, liberals and conservatives. And we see that every day. You see the battles in the Congress and the state legislatures out in the arenas of public discourse. We see it on issues like reproductive rights, school prayer. We see it on issues like constitutionally required balanced budget. We see it on gun control and a number of other issues. Constantly, these are the areas where the battles occur, less regulation, issues like reducing taxes, sometimes at a too general level of deliberation. What we don't see is where we agree, even though it's already out there in terms of public opinion, convergence between liberals and conservatives, and even though we have historical examples where odd bedfellows, as the press usually calls it, have gotten together and achieved what either group could not achieve by itself. Conservatives couldn't have done it, and liberals couldn't have done it, and when they got together, it happened. And this book is about the areas where it has happened in recent history. It's about where it could happen, and it's about changing our psychology. Because what happens when we get into ideological cul-de-sacs? It's a comfortable thing. We love to talk to people who agree with us, and we tend to exaggerate and stereotype the other side. Why? Because all the radio talk show hosts focus on the conflicts, and the politicians focus on the conflicts, because that's one way they raise their money. They say, well, we represent left, we represent right, you got to support us, and then they list the issues that we're disagreeing about. So the premise of this book basically is this. There are a lot of things we can get done in this country. Country is full of problems it doesn't deserve and solutions it doesn't apply. And that's really the democracy gap. And the democracy gap is that vacuum where millions of people want to see redirections, changes, and reforms in this country and its place in the world, but they don't know how to get it done. And if they try to get it done just with liberals or just with conservatives, they can't get it done. But if they align together, a lot of things happen. People's morale go up, they sense victory, because a left-right alliance, in almost all cases, is a significant majority. And not only is it a significant majority, but it gives cover to a lot of politicians who might want to do the right thing, but they don't have cover. They don't cover by their side, or they'll be exposed to the other side. Now, I want to give a lot of examples because I've always had this theory that if you talk about important matters in a society at a general level, people don't remember it. I don't remember it. Goes in one ear and out the other. So let me start with the first idea that I had that sparked the book was we were fighting the Clinch River Breeder Reactor. It was a nuclear reactor supposed to breed its own fuel. It was going to be built by the taxpayer on the Clinch River in Tennessee. And it was basically what would the right wing would call crony capitalism, we'd call corporate welfare. Mr. Reagan was for it. President Carter was against it, but this was 1983. Mr. Reagan was for it. General Electric, Westinghouse, a lot of companies, engineering firms were for it. And it started out as a projection of $1.5 billion. And then it was going to $3 billion. And then there were some official estimates it was going to end up at $8 billion. And they already spent $1.5 billion, and they didn't even dig a shovel on the Clinch River. So we opposed it because we thought that it would lead to plutonium vulnerability in terms of national security, and that it wouldn't work technologically. And the right wing opposed it because it was a tax disaster. It was a waste of taxpayer money. But we're trying to lobby the opposition in Congress. Senator Bumpers from Arkansas calls up and says, why don't you connect with some of these right wing or right of center groups, like the Competitive Enterprise Institute. So we said, that's a pretty good idea. So we got together, formed a group, Taxpayers Against Clinch River, and in a stunning victory, we beat them 56-40 in the Senate against real heavy corporate lobbying supported by the president. And I said to myself, this is really quite an opportunity. This isn't a situation where we cut the mustard. Left-right alliance is not bipartisanship. It's not where we say, well, let's agree. The military can send 5 submarines to Afghanistan. The right wants 5. The left wants nothing. And let's say just 2.5 submarines. No, it isn't that kind of thing. It's where we already agree that we don't like the Patriot Act's restrictions on civil liberties, and it's coming up for renewal next year, and we want to amend it. In specific areas that left-right already agree. And it's where left-right doesn't like the bloated military budget and empire and disastrous wars abroad and the violation of international law and a drain on the treasury and the damage to our soldiers and the horrendous damage to the natives in these countries like Iraq and Afghanistan that's boomeranging. No, we want to come back. There's America to build and renovate at the community level all over the country, creating good jobs that can't be exported to China. So you have left-right that, in effect, does not like corporate welfare. They don't like corporate subsidies, handouts, giveaways, bailouts. I interviewed Ed Crane, one of the founders of the arch-libertarian Cato Institute in Washington, and he's very concise. One would almost say he's brusque. And he said, Ralph, I oppose all corporate subsidies, unconstitutional wars, liberty-restricting Patriot Act, and the Federal Reserve run amok. And I said, well, that's a pretty good start, Ed. That's a pretty good start. And so we're dealing here with different categories of left-right stages. You start with public opinion. For example, counterintuitively, 70-80% of the American people favor restoration of the minimum wage, at least inflation adjusted from 1968, it would be $10.90. It's federal, $7.25, stuck, and California's going to go to $9 and maybe higher. You have 30 million workers in this country. Just think of that, 30 million workers out of about 140 million who are making less today in inflation-adjusted dollars, purchasing power, than workers made in 1968. That holds true for Walmart workers, for example. Under Sam Walton, Walmart workers made in real money more than they make today, even though worker productivity has doubled throughout those years. And when you come in 70-80% on an issue, you know there's a lot of conservatives and liberals in that category. And that is starting to go operational. It's operational in cities now, that like San Jose, that have raised the minimum wage at the city level. It's going operational in 21 states that have moved up to $8.50, $9 an hour. And Congress itself is starting to get the message. And it turns out that a few weeks ago, almost in the same week, Mitt Romney, Rick Santorum, and Tim Pawlenty, the Republican former governor of Minnesota, came out for a restoration of the minimum wage, joining that arch-conservative Phyllis Schlafly. So you see, it's moving operational. So you basically have about four stages. It starts with public opinion, then it congeals, becomes more visible, whether through petitions or referendum or marches or rallies, left, right. And then the press starts reporting it, and then it reaches the table of some candidates for office, incumbents or challengers. And once it reaches the table, it is discussable. Most of these left-right alliance issues are really off the table of the Republican-Democratic Party. They do not want to discuss it. And once it's not discussable, obviously it's going nowhere. And what the left-right alliance says is, no, we're going to have this discussed in elections and public opinion and debate. So we see, for instance, this tiny budget in the federal realm, you know, the military budget, $800 billion. It's half of the federal operating budget. There's no more Soviet Union. China is not going to send missiles, not while we send them their jobs, our jobs and industry. So why do we have such a large budget? Well, it's what Eisenhower warned us about. The military-industrial complex is insatiable, and it's always looking to find an enemy to justify all this armament and all these military contracts. And it's pretty hard, you know, trying to make $800 billion worth of fighting some criminal gangs abroad or some exaggerated third world country peril. So what happens is you have to cover up. And the way you cover up is you don't audit the Pentagon budget. The Pentagon budget has not been audited decade after decade. Now, any business person knows that if you don't audit your business, you're not going to find out where the money is and where it's being spent and wasted, never mind prudent business strategy and allocation. And so the Government Accounting Office, the arm of Congress, every year it reports on the different departments and agencies. Every year it says, alas, we don't have the data that would allow us to audit the Pentagon budget because the Pentagon doesn't have the data. And so we discovered $9 billion disappeared in the first few weeks of the invasion of Iraq, which is a criminal invasion, unconstitutional, based on lies and deceptions now taken for granted, except by Dick Cheney. And the State Department is not that better under Hillary Clinton. $6 billion couldn't be accounted for. So what do you think the left-right comes in on auditing the Pentagon budget? It's screamingly high, over 90%. It comes in left-right 90% to break up the big New York banks that are deemed too big to fail. And therefore, if they crash again, they crash the economy and the taxpayers have to bail them out. That comes in about 90%. The idea of initiative referendum recall, there's a lot of procedural democratic reforms that left-right are insistently on the same side. On the same side, they want voice. Whether they agree or disagree, they want voice. And if the lawmakers don't provide a way to reflect that voice, then they want the initiative referendum and recall. The drug wars are now being subjected to a left-right alliance. Grover Norquist and Newt Gingrich has started a group called Right on Crime. They got too many people in jail for long sentences for nonviolent offenses, and it's costing billions of dollars. And the right wing doesn't like that. It's a waste of money. And the left thinks it's also a waste of money, but they think it's a terrible way to treat people if you want to avoid recidivism and if you have any sense of human rights. And so sometimes they're both on the same side, left-right, but for different reasons. Try NAFTA and the World Trade Organization. Left-right, now in the House of Representatives, represent enough to stop what's been called NAFTA on steroids, which is the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement. And it doesn't just deal with trade. It deals with subordinating consumer, worker, environmental standards to the supremacy of commercial trade, all in secret, all decided literally in secret tribunals such as the ones in Geneva, Switzerland. Quite different from our open courts and our regulatory processes and the legislative processes. So why is the right wing opposed? Because they think it shreds our sovereignty. Why is the left opposed? Because they think it shreds our decision-making, but they also think it unfairly ships millions of jobs and industries to autocratic regimes, fascist, communist regimes, who know how to keep their workers in their place at 80 cents an hour. So we have juvenile justice reform being passed in 15 states now because of left-right legislators getting together and shortening some of those outrageous sentences for small possession of marijuana or other street drugs. Now, in the book, on page 65, 66, I have 25 areas of convergence. And as I go around the country, people suggest other areas of convergence. Some of them are national, some of them are local. The liberals have to get over their distaste to even associate with right-wingers. I found that the right-wingers are more interested in this book than the left. And I'm asking myself, why? And I want to be very concise, because in television, you got to give people sound bites. So if a television reporter asks me, what's the problem with liberals not, you know, getting together with Grover Norquist and Newt Gingrich? I mean, do you know what these people stand for? I mean, how can you stand it? And so I've got it down better than a sound bite. It's called a sound bark. Here's the problem. It's the ick factor. Like, oh, how can we associate with these people? How can we deal with them? We disagree with them. Well, you disagree with them on A, B, C, D. So what? That doesn't mean you don't work with them on W, X, Y, Z. To lift the taboos and all the repressive forces that keep people from saying what they think and doing what they want and building a better society and having the U.S. be known as a humanitarian superpower instead of just a military superpower with enough armaments that can blow the world up 300 times over and make the rubble bounce. That was one calculation by an industrial engineer. Well, let me just summarize this because we want to get into the next stage. Cracking down on corporate crime. People are very upset that the people in Wall Street who, for a variety of reasons, criminal greed, negligence, stupidity, excessive speculation, never were prosecuted. And they did violate laws. And not one went to jail. Some inside traders went, a handful went to jail, but not the bosses. That comes in overwhelmingly left-right. What happens when you're dealing with left-right issues and you go down the abstraction ladder from the ethereal ideological clashes to where people live, work, and raise their families? Right down where they live, work, and raise their families. A lot of the ideology dissipates because whether you're conservative family or liberal family, you're facing reality. And when you face reality, you have some of the common principles of fair play, if you will, the golden rule, becomes the applicable yardstick for evaluating proper behavior. And also they have children. And Republican, Democrat. So what? The Koch brothers are putting money into state legislatures to trying to surtax solar panels, because now solar panels are competitive with their oil and gas interests. And so they're putting money in counterintuitively to raise taxes on solar panels. And guess what? They're losing. Because in these legislatures, there are Republicans and Democrats who say, what are you, crazy? You mean there's a Republican solar panel or a Democratic solar panel? We want solar panels. It creates jobs in the communities. They're not getting what they usually get, the Koch brothers. So I think it's important for us to discuss these issues. The book is designed for discussion. It's designed to turn some of the 90% of the thousands of book clubs in this country who will only deal with fiction books because they don't want controversy. You know, I go fishing with Ray, but I never talk politics. You know, how many times have you heard that one? Like, oh, that's sinful. You know, talk politics. That's only the central way that we try to have a rule of law and have a system of equity so we can get things done and fulfill human possibilities. They turn politics into a dirty word. How many times have you confronted people who think they're smart because they're cynical? Ah, pox on both their houses. Right? And you should say to them, you know, there are two easy ways to go through life. One is to believe everything, and the other is to believe nothing, and they both avoid thinking. And if you withdraw, and if you quit from democracy, you create a vacuum, and you know power abhors a vacuum. And so this book is designed to be vibrantly discussed. I must say, no one's written a book like this before. I go into the conservative philosophers, the big ones like Adam Smith, Ludwig von Mises, Friedrich Hayek, Fred Meyer, Russell Kirk, and I found out that the corporatists who masquerade as conservatives have distorted these people. That sure, they were dead set against socialism, dead set about centralized government planning, but they're incredibly humane in terms of their social philosophy. Friedrich Hayek is cited by Congressman Paul Ryan as his mentor. And one reason is that he opposed Medicare and Medicaid. He opposed Medicare and Medicaid because it was discriminatory. He wanted health insurance for everybody. And he also wanted a minimum incomes plan to deal with raw poverty, which Milton Friedman picked up and persuaded Nixon to send to the Congress. Unfortunately, the Congress didn't pass it. Ludwig von Mises, I mean, he said, do not put too many burdens on the market system. There are other important value systems in a society that cannot be reflected by a market system. Another way of putting it is, markets are good servants, but bad masters. Corporations are chartered by the state to be our servants. That's the historical reality. They have turned so often in the giant conglomerate fashion to be our masters. And so I hope that you will take this idea and meet your counterparts in the community and start forming liberal conservative alliances on whatever issue you think you both agree on instead of being divided and ruled. We're running out of time in this country where we can continue to call ourselves a democracy. It's increasingly, and I see people who are very wealthy using these words, it's a plutocracy, an oligarchy. One of the richest men in America told me, how are things with the plutocracy, Ralph? I couldn't believe it. They're talking about it that way, and the figures bear them out. The top 1% of the richest people have financial wealth equal to the financial combined wealth of the bottom 95% of the American people. I'm going to end on this note. Whether it's eminent domain, taking homes and giving it to Pfizer Corporation in New London, or whether it's cartel regulation, that is regulation that impedes market competition and is pushed through Congress in order to favor certain commercial interests over others, or whether it's examples of great success of left-right alliance, the Auto Safety Act passed unanimously in the House of Representatives against powerful auto industry, Freedom of Information Act passed against commercial lobbying opposition in 1974, the False Claims Act that has saved tens of billions of dollars of fraud on the government passed against powerful commercial interests because Republican Senator Grassley teamed up with Democrat Howard Berman in the House of Representatives and got it through. And last year we had the Whistleblower Protection Act that was opposed by corporate lobbyists. Left-right got it through. Left-right almost got a bill through the legislature against the Republican-Democrat leaders to ban the NSA from dragnet snooping over the American people. Just missed. Stunned the Congress. But when members of Congress see a left-right coming in, whether it's emails, telephones, visits, they know the writing's on the wall, and they know it's unstoppable. And what we have to constantly keep in mind is not just past successes, but how fast we can turn this country around. A country, again, that has more problems than it deserves and more solutions than it applies in one area after another. Anybody who thinks that we have to wait 10, 15, 20 years to make major changes, long overdue in our country, many of them already made in Western Europe, like better public transit, 4 weeks paid vacation, like better labor laws, higher wages in the lower one-third category, free tuition for higher education, and such things as better pensions, a whole number of things. If you say, well, the taxes are higher. Well, they may be a little higher, but look what they get for it. They get universal health insurance. They never have to go into student debt. They get the residual back from their taxes, and our residual goes into massive military budgets and corporate welfare boondoggles. Last point goes into history. I just read a book recently called The First American Revolution, and it was before Lexington and Concord by a year, and the farmers in central and western Massachusetts. You know, Boston takes credit for Lexington and Concord. Boston was a military garrison run by General Gage, the emissary of King George III. One out of 19 people in Massachusetts lived in Boston in 1774. It was the farmers that started it. And the way they started it was completely nonviolent. It was extraordinary. When King George ruled that he was going to appoint, through his emissaries, all the town officials and the sheriffs and the judges, that was the last straw for the farmers. And what they did was they picked out these Tories in their midst who were trying to implement this draconian law, and they would show up around the house of the Tory, very quiet, very dignified. They'd knock on the door, and they'd say, we're here, we're your neighbors, we provide you with food, you know who we are, we want you to recant. We want you to say you will not enforce that law. And do you know how many showed up? 500. 1,000 showed up in those days. It wasn't easy. There weren't really many roads. There were dirt paths. But they showed up, and they were very, very keen on not being accused of being riotous, and they showed up. And this is what we have to do. We have to show up. My favorite bill is the $2 bill. I don't know how many of you have seen the picture on the other side. This is a picture of the people who showed up to sign the Declaration of Independence in July 4, 1776. Okay, they're white males, and they were upper income. But when they signed that declaration, they knew they were possibly signing their death warrant because they were taking on the most powerful military force in the world, in the British Empire. And so I say to all of us, half a democracy is showing up. And if we're not going to show up, especially in a left-right alliance, town meetings, the precincts to vote, the courtrooms, the marches, the rallies, we won't get this great democratic experiment maturing as it should in the 21st century. And if we don't do that, given the trends of decay and decline, our descendants are going to curse us for the kind of country we handed forward. And all of us have our own occupations, professions, and businesses. But we also are all citizens, and we have to allot time for that precious and most important responsibility. Thank you.
Think will be the candidates for president in 2016?
You know, I could be flippant and say it's not relevant because they represent the same interests, except for a few categories that are important in the civil liberties area, but on national security and corporate welfare and not doing anything about the tax code and empire and war, it's so drearily similar by both parties, and I could add a number of other categories. If I had to guess now, and it'll be a wrong guess, but right now, the dynasty returns. Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton.
And will Ralph Nader jump into this?
No.
No. Okay.
But I do want to encourage a billionaire or two to turn it into a 3- or 4-way race. And there should be an enlightened billionaire, especially in this area of the country, who, you know, rather seriously concerned about the state of the country. And I'm serious about that. I sent letters to 20 billionaires.
Yes, I know.
Urging him to do that. And, however, you know, it's a long way to Iowa and the caucuses, so anything can happen. I just wrote a column saying, I think Jerry Brown is not going to go to Iowa and New Hampshire, but I think he's standing for president. And he's waiting. If Hillary falters, he's ready. And he's done everything plus and minus to be as invulnerable as possible to political attack. Plus, he's balanced the budget. And he's run 3 times, so he still has that taste.
Okay. Our thanks to Ralph Nader, political activist and author of the new book, Unstoppable, The Emerging Left and Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. So we'll do some more questions here. This is a great question. Is it disheartening to you that nearly 50 years after the publication of Unsafe at Any Speed, automakers are still covering up safety issues? What do you think should be done?
Well, you're probably referring to the GM cover-up for 10, 12 years on the ignition switch, and there have been other cover-ups. I think the Congress is now seriously considering tightening the auto safety laws, increasing the auto safety budget, the enforcement budget. That would be a good thing out of this tragedy. That's what we're pushing for. Laws have to be renovated, just like machines, human beings. They have to be renewed, and this is just another renewal. At least now they're talking about recalls. When I started, they wouldn't even admit recalls. They either would never recall or they send a secret bulletin to the dealer. You know, if your customers bring in this car, you know, it does have a sticking throttle. So, you know, here's the repair unit.
Has GM broken the law? Should people be prosecuted? And
yes.
What would be, for what, and what would be the just punishment?
Well, when we lobbied the auto safety bill through, the opposing lobbyists for the auto companies cut out the criminal penalty. Even willful, knowing violation of safety standards that kill people. There's only civil penalties and not that many millions of dollars in maximum fine. So now, that's one thing we're proposing in the renovation of the criminal penalty. But GM violated another law, which basically says you have to report immediately when you find a defect to the Department of Transportation. And the Justice Department has a ongoing criminal inquiry now into the GM matter. And another law that they violated, which is omnibus, it's across the board, it's obstruction of justice. So if they can document GM stonewalled, covered up, didn't deliver the emails, the internal memos to the investigators from the Department of Transportation, they're in deep trouble.
And the just punishment would be?
Well, some would be you prosecute people up. You don't just prosecute a lowly engineer, which is what GM is trying to get away with. You prosecute people up. There's going to be a very heavy fine on GM. It's going to be well over $1 billion. They hit Toyota for $1.5 billion a couple years ago. That's not all that much, by the way, for GM. But the other part, and if there's a settlement, there's very rarely a trial, that GM will have to restructure its operation so that the CEO is immediately informed of defect discoveries and can't say, I didn't know about it. And the top brass cannot say, I didn't know about it. So I've suggested an independent ombudsman who receives confidentially the reports of conscientious engineers inside GM where they're protected from retaliation against their career or promotion. And then the ombudsman has to zing it right to the CEO, in this case, Mary Barra, and she has to decide, and she's got the skin in the game. She's on a hot seat when to send it to the Department of Transportation. They're trying to shuffle the company this way, that way, horizontally, vertically. It's a huge bureaucracy. It's not going to work. This is the way it works.
Have you ever used Uber or Lyft?
No.
What have you ever used Airbnb?
No.
So what do you think of these new startup companies where people just give someone a ride in their car or have them stay in their house?
It's the same questions we would all ask. Are they regulated for safety? Are they licensed for being expert drivers? Is the car inspected? They usually have to have a car that's no more than 3 years old or so for Uber. And it's unfair. If they are not properly regulated, certified to safeguard the passenger, it's unfair to the cab industry. The reason why it arose is because people were tired of waiting for cabs. In Washington, you could wait half an hour. People want right away. And now the cab drivers are answering the phone more quickly. I see fewer busy signals, you know. So it's had that salutary effect. Now, in New York, they're starting to regulate Uber, and I think that's the way it's going to end up. And, of course, the more drivers there are, the less Uber drivers are going to make. Right now, they're making quite a bit of money compared to cab drivers.
And do you have an opinion on Airbnb?
It's the same thing. I don't mind, you know, decentralizing, you know, making people ad hoc small business. I don't mind that. But you got, I mean, if you're going to find a room in some house on Elm Street, there have to be certain standards instead of going to, say, a motel.
So should there be, should the city of San Francisco heavily regulate Airbnb?
All that should be regulated. If you're challenging a regulated industry and you're unregulated and you can see the problems, they're not just theoretical, that's unfair competition.
This is a great question, and this to me is one of those issues where the right and the left can quickly agree. Mr. Nader, would you share your opinion of GMO corn, well, not that one, and the ethanol fuel mandate? That one.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't know about liberals on this, but I think there's a lot of conservatives and a good slice of people liberal who are discovering that ethanol is a waste of taxpayer dollars. It's a subsidy. Number two, it does not help the environment the way it was exaggerated on its introduction. I mean, sugarcane ethanol is much more efficient. Number three, it almost costs as much to produce the corn as the BTUs you get out of the corn when it's burned. Number four, why do you want to burn food in a hungry world? And number five, you're likely to increase, and the studies have shown, you're likely to marginally increase supermarket prices because of any shortages that occur, because let's say they're replacing soy and replacing other products that are often in a cyclical short supply, up it goes. I'm all for the abolition. But when I was campaigning in Iowa, right from the start, they asked me, what's your opinion on ethanol? And I said, out of here. That made me real popular.
Yeah, it is for, and GMO corn? Genetically modified corn?
Any GMO. First of all, it's corporate science, Monsanto. It is not academic science. Corporate science is secret. It's proprietary information. It's not peer-reviewed by other scientists. It's not open as political power, which goes beyond its merits, and it is commercially driven in terms of what you choose to do research on, where academic science is open, peer-reviewed. Some scientists may want to support something that doesn't have to make an immediate profit, but it's very good for human beings. The other thing, and I've just written a long introduction to a book called The GMO Deception that's full of articles by scientists and investigative reporters saying, open it up, folks. This is too secret and too tumultuous a technology. Changing the nature of nature, flora, fauna, corporations owning our genetic sequences in terms of monopoly patents. Let's have a discussion. There's no ethical legal framework. It's essentially unregulated. And you have farmers who don't want to grow GMO crops. They're being contaminated by the winds wafting the farms that do use GMO crops. So it is a trap. In other countries, it's worse than that. It allies itself with industrial farming, dispossessing millions of farmers in places like India.
Who are the best people in government today? Who were the worst? Name names.
You have to take them.
That's my favorite kind of question.
You have to take them piece by piece. Like, I think Senator Elizabeth Warren is very good on consumer financial issues, debtor-creditor relations, big banks, bailouts. You know, she really knows her stuff. I don't think she's very good on foreign and military policy. I think she follows the Obama line, partially because she doesn't know that much. That's not her area, but I hold her up to higher levels. Rand Paul, I can't stand his positions. He's against Medicare. He's against health and safety regulation. He doesn't like environmental standards mandated. I think he's skeptical on climate change, and he hates taxation. You wonder where all this is going to be funded. But he's against empire. He's for open information, and he's against the bloated military budget. We had an amazing thing happen in 2010. Barney Frank and Ron Paul, his father, they're both congressmen, they got together in a caucus, and they staffed it to take on the bloated military budget, left, right there. A lot of taboos get lifted, and you'll find a lot of politicians who you don't think agree with you, and they're free. They can be like Martin Luther King, free at last, free at last. Once you take those taboos out. I could go on with, the others. I mean, in the Congress you're talking about, Deborah?
Well, the question was in Washington, so.
Yeah. I mean, look, I would vote for 15% of the Congress. I'd willingly vote for them. 1-5. Going down.
I know you like Jerry Brown. Who do you like from California?
California, well, again, on domestic issue, George Miller, I like him very much.
He's retiring.
He's retiring. Henry Waxman represents to me, I have this rule. I'm for term limits, but not 6 years, 12 years. Why, they ask me? Because after 12 years, most of the members of Congress either wear out or sell out. They wear out, literally. They just lose their spark and their initiative. And Henry Waxman has done neither. He's the supreme legislator. The greatest legislator in my 45, 50 now years in Washington was Congressman John Moss from Sacramento, hands down.
How can corporations be stopped from moving their businesses overseas to prevent paying?
Well, this is where President Obama is doing the right thing. He asks these corporations, where's your economic patriotism? And it's legal to do what Deborah mentioned, strip themselves of their U.S. citizenship as corporations, charters, and reincorporate in Switzerland, Luxembourg, Ireland, which has a lower corporate tax rate. And he says it may be legal. It's the wrong thing to do. The idea is they keep the 8,000 Walgreens stores. Pfizer keeps getting all these benefits from the NIH, free research and development, clinically tested for drugs. They give away free to various drug companies. All the public infrastructure, the law, the enforcement of contracts, the courts, they get all that, but they don't want to pay their fair share of taxes. And people, you hear the Wall Street Journal say, we have the highest corporate tax rate in the Western world, 35%. Who pays 35%? Some small businesses may. The average income tax payments of the top 500 corporations is 13%. You have, year after year, General Electric making billions of profits in the U.S. paying zero federal income tax. One GE worker sends more money to the U.S. Treasury than the entire General Electric company. And if you want to get the list of all this extremely accurate, go to citizensfortaxjustice.org, CTJ. .org, you'll see 25 major corporations, most of them paying either no taxes, 3%, 5%, whatever. As far as I'm concerned, a major yardstick to evaluate giant U.S. corporations from now on is patriotism. The corporations are told by the Supreme Court that they are persons, that they are people, okay? If they're persons and they're people, we're gonna judge them by people's standards. whether they're unpatriotic or whether drug companies are kleptomaniacs, or whether hospital chains suffer from attention deficit disorder with their patients, or whether GM refuses to be toilet trained, from now on, it's anthropomorphous.
Now, this is not a question I would ask, but how do you feel about causing Al Gore to lose the election and making George W. Bush president?
This is amazing. How many answers in rapid fashion do you want to that question? Here's one. Here's a basic one. And we use this in petitioning because people often didn't want to sign our petitions to get on the ballot in state after state because they were either Democrats or they liked the two-party system. And what worked almost all the time was saying, you may not agree and you may not vote for Ralph Nader and Winona LaDuke, but will you sign this petition to get on the ballot in order to give the people in California who want to vote for Nader and Winona LaDuke the choice to do so? Okay? So either we are all equal, have equal right to run for president, and therefore we're trying to take votes from one another, and therefore we can be called spoilers of one another, or none of us are spoilers. Third-party candidates, Libertarian, Green, are not second-class citizens. And the last I heard is George W. Bush took more votes away from Gore than I did. Now, I've asked Gore this. People have asked Gore. Gore doesn't even come close to blaming the Green Party. He says there are a dozen things that happened. He thinks it was stolen from him in a variety of ways in Florida. He thinks that he lost his home state of Tennessee. Had he won it, everything else happening the same, he'd be in the White House. He didn't think that winning the popular vote should lose him the White House because of the Electoral College. I mean, that's going to be abolished in about 2-3 years by an interstate compact. Imagine coming in second like Bush did in the popular vote, and he's appointed by 5-4 of the Supreme Court, and they had no business doing that. So there are about 20 sine qua nons, any one of which would have put them. But how dare they? How dare these two parties who turn their back on workers and ignore consumer abuses and get us involved in all kinds of wars and huge loss of money and sacrifice of soldiers boomeranging against us? They both knee-jerk and give the authority to the president, Bush or Obama, unconstitutionally to decide when to initiate wars. And they give our tax dollars for all these subsidies and bailouts. I mean, how dare they say that someone shouldn't challenge them from either the right, left, or center? It's absolutely outrageous. It is political bigotry at its worst. By the way, 250,000 Democrats in Florida voted for Bush. Who's going to blame them?
What is your opinion about illegal immigration? What would you do about it?
Well, first of all, I change American foreign policy to stop supporting suppressive dictators and oligarchs in Mexico, Central America, that abuse and starve their people that these people have to go north of the Rio Grande to feed their families. Most people don't like to leave their native land. And if these countries were allowed to prosper, and they had interesting population ratios 50, 80 years ago in terms of natural resources, Central America couldn't feed itself, Mexico, that's step one. Step two, NAFTA dumped a lot of taxpayer-subsidized corn into Mexico and dispossessed 1 million Mexican workers, farmers, and their families, heading to Monterrey, Mexico City, or north. That was an effect there. Third, I believe we have to control our borders. We have to control them so we don't drive down wages in this country. The Wall Street Journal wants open borders, and we know why. We have to control them for smuggling. We have to control them for infectious diseases. And we have to control them for two-way pollution trends. So I believe in controlling borders. Finally, if there are immigrants who come in unlawfully, and after 5, 10, 15 years, employers hire them, they pay their taxes, they do work honorably, there comes a time when the equitable doctrine of laches moves in. In other words, It is a misdemeanor to come in illegally in this country. It's not a felony. There comes a time when we have to say they are merited and they should be kept here. And if we want to prosecute anyone, we should prosecute the poultry processors, the meat packers, and the various employers who want to lure them in so they can pay them dirt wages and challenge them to object to horrible working conditions like in the tomato fields in Florida, because if they do, they're exposed and they can be harassed and thrown out of the country. So they got captive workers there. The employers have a serious responsibility here.
So what do you think of the DREAM Act?
When it comes to children who are born here, mm-hmm. What's their responsibility? They should have equal rights, you know, with the rest of the people. However, we shouldn't, you know, in the next 15 years, allow 15 million people to come into this country. You can't keep doing that. And I don't believe in brain drain. I think we should restrict that H-1B visa. The very idea that we tell developing countries, get yourself in order here, use your human resources, get yourself more engineers, scientists, doctors, nurses, come on, develop your economy, and then we brain drain them into our country instead of developing our own talent and having more people skilled from lower income areas in this country. Other nations in Africa and Asia and South America, they need doctors, entrepreneurs, engineers, scientists, nurses desperately. Why are we importing doctors? We don't have enough brains in this country to increase the number of primary care doctors. This is a very bad brain drain. I would have very strict controls on H-1B visas.
And what about these 50,000 plus unaccompanied minors who are coming to the border now? There's a big, you know, the president I'm not sure what he wants to do, actually. He seems to have changed his mind a couple times. But he wants to change the 2008 Wilberforce Act, or he didn't, and he changed his mind on that. Sorry. But, I mean, what would you do about it if you were president?
You know, tens of thousands of people have been killed in Mexico in the last few years and now in Central America because of drug wars. It's spilling over in this country, worse and worse. We also have our drive-by shootings, right? What are we doing? What are we doing not decriminalizing, regulating these drugs, and having a major effort, a slice of what the drug war costs us, for rehabilitation at all ages in order to detoxify and get these people off drugs? Are we willing to pay the penalty of constant underground drug machinations and drug wars, where in these countries they're killing judges, bribing police? No one talks about that. Now, what would happen if we criminalized alcohol consumption or tobacco smoking? Drugs, all addictive substances should be viewed first and foremost as health problems, not as criminal behavior for users.
Yeah, what do you do about traffickers?
Pardon?
What do you do about traffickers? So if you want to decriminalize usage, what do you do
There are no traffickers once you legalize it. Storekeepers.
Well, you said you want to legalize.
And they're taxed.
Okay. So you want to legalize all drugs?
You have to. I mean, by the way, heroin and cocaine, 19th century, they weren't illegal. Mm-hmm. We have a different society now, obviously, in mobility and transnational migrations. But look, you can never suppress addiction by law. It's going to burst out in the most ferocious, destructive, addictive ways, right down to suicides and homicides. The only way is to bring it up, surface it, decriminalize it, regulate it, tax it, and then move toward rehabilitation clinics all over the country. That's what we're doing in tobacco. That's what we're doing in tobacco now.
I'm sure you noticed the New York Times editorial that called for the legalization of marijuana and of the federal ban.
Huge editorials, three of them so far.
That's right. It was. Now, do you think that this country will legalize marijuana in the next 5 years?
Yes. I mean, I do not like drug addiction. I mean, let me tell you, mm-hmm. I'm very strong on this. But I have studied the history of trying to criminalize personal addictions It's what the former dean of the Harvard Law School once said about other things. There are certain patterns of behavior in human society that are beyond the effective range of legal action. You can't prosecute them enough. They'll proliferate in all kinds of brutal ways. And so surface it, regulate it, tax it, and rehabilitate. That's what's happening. When I started opposing the tobacco industry in 1964, when the Surgeon General's report came out, 47% of all adults smoked. It's now 18% lower in California, nationwide. That's a huge consumer movement. That is, 400,000 people a year die from tobacco-induced diseases. I mean, you want to talk about a terror. But now it's going to decline. And also, you won't be able to absorb other people's smoke, non-smoking. We pushed for non-smoking compartments in railroads, buses, and airplanes, and then eliminate. And 1988 was the last day when you can get on a U.S. airliner and have anyone smoke. And I happened to be on a flight from Washington to Buffalo, and I was the last guy on the plane. There was one seat by the window in the rear, and I'm going down the aisle with my suitcase, and this guy in the middle looks at me with a gleam. He can't believe it. I'm sitting next to him, and he said, "You! It's you who did this." And all the way to Buffalo, he's blowing smoke in my face, and I'm doing the vent, you know, try to get... When we landed, and it was the last time he could ever smoke, he blew the last thing in my face, and he said, and I said, "Are you satisfied?" He said, "Yes, it was worth it." And I said, "Well, I hope you enjoyed it, because you're never going to do it again."
I've asked the last question. So let me thank Ralph Nader, political activist, author of the new book, Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Alliance to Dismantle the Corporate State. I also want to thank our audience here, audience on radio, television, the internet. And I want to remind everyone here that copies of Mr. Nader's book are on sale in the lobby, and he'll be pleased to sign them in this room immediately following the program. I'm Deborah J. Saunders. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, in the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.